Today I'm with Robin Stevenson, Head of Private Clients at Swindells Accounting, and we wanted to spend the next 20-25 minutes looking at some critical tax year or end of tax year planning. So we're going to cover off and try and impart as many nuggets as we can in the areas of income tax, capital gains tax, inheritance tax, bring in a bit of pension planning, and then some of the obvious tax favoured investments. So it's a great delight to have my colleague Robin with me today. But Robin, should we kick off with income tax?
That's a good place to start, isn't it?
What should we go with? Let's go with the allowances and some of the... So let's pull out the things, some of the things that we see, which are perhaps slightly less efficient, that people could take action with and would offer some meaningful tax savings.
Well, it's not only getting... making best use of the allowances this year as well, it's also getting ready for next year. And there are still an awful lot of people who are wasting their personal allowances, so we need to make sure that doesn't happen. The personal allowance for this year, 18-19, is £11,850. And earnings over that then get taxed at 20%. So it seems silly to me if we have, for example, one spouse earning over that amount and paying 20% tax, whereas the other spouse is not using their personal allowance. So we'd always look to see whether there's any income we could shift from one spouse to another.
So if it's not income, if they're employed, that may be tricky to shift it. But if they weren't employed, what sort of thing were you thinking? Thinking of shifting maybe interest, investment income?
You have to gift the asset across. So such investment income, such as company share dividends, for example, it might be interest bearing accounts, or which is often the case, is rental income from properties.
Good point.
So making sure those are either jointly owned or owned in a tax-efficient manner to make sure the income lands on the person paying the least amount of tax or with surplus allowances available.
Okay. Should we look at some of the classic breakpoints in our wonderfully simple tax system? So if we're talking, perhaps the first one might be that higher rate threshold. So obviously if earnings tip over a higher rate threshold, some of the things you should be doing or consider doing?
Well, some of this, depending on your income, is a matter of timing. If you're a business owner, for example, and you are receiving company share dividends, you should keep an eye on your income. And it may be just by delaying a dividend from this tax year and pay it on the 6th of April means that income does not hit your taxable income for this year. Instead, it'll land in next year where you have a whole fresh load of allowances which are available to you.
Okay, so there's a timing thing there. But I guess typically we would be saying to people, if it's difficult to, as we said previously about perhaps income shifting, manipulation, the first very obvious thing for if you've got income over 46,000-ish at the moment would be to make that 46,350, if I could be so precise there. It would be to make a pension contribution.
Absolutely, and the pension contribution is very valuable as well because the personal allowance is reduced when your income exceeds £100,000. So you may have £100,000 worth of income. Anything over that starts to eat away at your personal allowance. And the tax rate, the marginal tax rate when that happens is a massive 60%. So ideally, we wouldn't want you to be in that tax bracket. So if your income is above £100,000 and you are effectively paying 60% tax on that, we'd look at some ways to reduce your income back down. And one of those ways is a pension contribution.
It's quite interesting, isn't it? Because we often see perhaps well-meaning employers offering or packages of £100,000 with a £20,000 bonus. But £20,000 bonus is then going to get taxed at 60% and they're going to lose, what, £12,000 of that £20,000 bonus, and it doesn't look quite so appealing thereafter.
No.
But so just quickly going back to that 46K, I suppose the mechanics, if we were saying, right, if somebody had 50K income, which we'll just make that point about child benefit as well, but 50K income, they need to make a gross pension, or if they made a gross pension contribution of £4,000, So that would be a net contribution of, say, £3,200. Government adds £800. They then get another 20% on the £4,000. So not only do they not pay any higher rate tax, they're then picking up a whole slug of tax relief on that pension contribution. So at the margin there, it can be very, very valuable. Likewise, you were saying over the 100,000, if you're making a pension contribution between, and your income is 100 and between 100 and 120, you're going to get essentially 60% income tax relief on a pension contribution. It's just impossible to generate that sort of relief doing anything else, really, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So just run our listeners through the child benefit thing. If your income's over 50, the principle behind that?
If your income's over £50,000, then for every £100 over that, the child benefit effectively gets withdrawn, or you have to repay it by 1%. So once your income gets up to about £60,000, that child benefit is gone.
Right.
So by looking at the level of your income as the year end approaches, this is where you might think of mechanisms to reduce your income back down.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just child benefits, it's also the tax thresholds we've just mentioned and things like that. So keep an eye on your income, your level of income, also your spouse, and consider if you are getting close to these thresholds or child benefit repayments, what we might be able to do to bring that income back down, and certainly to stay away from that 60% tax band.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the other thing I know you wanted to point out was about the reduction in this tax year. So in the current tax year, the dividend allowance, another one of our beautifully simple allowances, it's now fallen from 5,000 to 2,000. So there's some planning around, or certainly some thought around that, but just pass your expertise over that allowance.
Well, these are company share dividends and they apply to all shareholders. So as you mentioned previously, up to 1718, individuals were allowed £5,000 dividends. That's been reduced down to £2,000, and that means £2,000 worth of dividends are tax-free in your hands. Now, if you have a share portfolio, okay, you may not be able to manage that. But if you're a company director, company shareholder, you need to make sure you pay enough dividends to make use of this allowance, because the allowance will disappear on the 5th of April. It's reduced, it's replaced by another one on the 6th. But I mean, if you think about it, you could take £2,000 out on the 4th of April, for example, and then another £2,000 out on the 6th of April, and £4,000 tax-free.
Okay. So again, going back to that point you made earlier about, can you shift it between husband and wife assets so the overall dividend income may only just be in excess of 2,000 for each of them. Not sure if you mentioned, just run listeners through the charitable donation option.
The charitable donation gives tax relief as well. So long as you tick the little box on the donation form and apply gift aid, then if your tax liability is running up into the higher rates of tax, you get a good piece of tax relief on those charitable donations. But as you mentioned, just nipping back to that £2,000 worth of dividends, if you are a company director and you have control over the company, things we might think about doing is maybe transferring some of the shares across to your wife, and she also takes £2,000 worth of dividends as well. So between the two of you, that's £4,000 a year tax-free. Do it on the 5th of April, then do it again on the 6th of April, then suddenly that's £8,000 completely tax-free.
I guess there's another point which we'll cover perhaps in a little bit more detail later, but the use of ISAs, for example, that if you're putting dividend-yielding investments into an ISA, then obviously that's not going to need to appear or count towards that £2,000 allowance. And then if we're going to probably be even more specific, if you want to choose perhaps the highest dividend paying investments and put those into an ISA, so it's perhaps the more growth orientated or lower dividend paying investments which remain outside of an ISA and therefore use less of your allowance. Again, simple things that you can be doing. And albeit some people might say, well, okay, I may not have a massive income tax issue at the moment, but as with all of these things, let's not assume that dividend allowance isn't going to get lowered or will remain at £2,000. So I think we probably covered most of the obvious points there from income tax. So should we move on to capital gains tax and just have a think there in terms of what sort of things people might consider doing and using to make sure some valuable allowances are not used from a capital gains tax perspective?
Well, each year you have an annual exempt allowance, and for 1819, the tax you are in at the moment is £11,700 per person. So that means you can make a capital gain. That isn't the proceeds, as some people think. That's actually the capital gain. So how much you sold it for, take away how much it cost you, that is the gain. If that is below £11,700, that's tax-free. So the point I want to make is that this allowance is available to you. And is there anything in your share portfolio or any other assets where you could actually make use of this, maybe rebase the shares?
Just run our listeners through rebase.
Rebasing is where you sell an asset and then you later buy it back. But by selling the asset, you're selling at a particular price and realizing the gain. And that is covered by the annual exemption. And when you rebuy the asset back again, then you bought it at a much higher base cost. So when you come to sell it, the base cost is so much higher.
Okay. I think there are one or two slightly complicated rules on repurchasing certain items.
Yes, it's called bed and breakfasting, for example. If you sell an asset, you sell some shares and rebuy them again within 30 days, then there are rules, which matching rules that stop us being quite so blasé about how we calculate the capital gains tax.
But perhaps, I suppose, worthwhile pointing out there are four good ways in which you can overcome that. One would be to say, right, if you're going to use your exemption like that, you can bed an ISA it, so you can sell it and buy back exactly the same thing in an ISA.
That would get around the matching rules, yes.
Okay, and then if you did a bed and SIP, so if you sold it and made a pension contribution, that would work as well. And obviously with a pension contribution, you're then going to say you've sold the asset, you've realised the gain, and then the contribution to the pension is ideally going to get tax relief as well. So there's a sort of double benefit of doing it that way. I know the other one that you were going to bring up was the bed and spouse. So if hypothetically you and I were married, mm-hmm. If I sold an investment and then you buy the same investment back,
exactly,
as it were.
So you bought the investment a couple of years ago, maybe for £1,000. You now sell it for £12,000, so you made £11,000 gain. That would be tax-free. But because that is you and I am me, to completely separate people, I can now buy that asset on exactly the same day for the £12,000, and therefore if it raises in value up to say £15,000, my gain is only three. It doesn't get rebased back down to the original £1,000 you paid for it.
Good point. And I think the final one is slightly crudely termed bed and something similar, but it would just working on the basis that if you said, right, okay, imagine I had an investment fund which was just tracking the UK stock market. Say, for example, you might have one with a company called Vanguard, but you could sell it and buy back a fund which does exactly the same thing, perhaps by Legal in General. So sort of bed and euphemistically called something similar. So you could do that, or I suppose if you had a share in Shell and you could buy one in BP if you wanted to stay in the oil sector. But it's selling something and buying something similar to cover that off. So on the capital gains tax, I know you wanted to also mention where you talk about income and having it, if you like, making sure that people are using allowances. At this same principle, Robin, about gains landing on the right person?
Exactly right. Married couples can transfer assets between each other completely tax-free. You have to be legally married, but so we make sure that's the case beforehand. If we were looking at an asset between us and we knew we were going to sell it, we might transfer the ownership between us, and therefore we both use our £11,700 allowance. It doesn't all fall on one of the partners.
Okay, good point. One perhaps slightly specific, if anybody was getting divorced, points they might need to be aware of in terms of tax year end planning regarding capital gains tax?
Yeah, it's quite specific, but the rules here are quite straightforward. So in the year of permanent separation, so in the tax year of permanent separation, if assets are transferred between the ex-husband and wife, then that is still covered by the spousal exemption. So there'll be no capital gains tax after permanent separation, provided those assets were transferred before the end of the tax year. If you separate in, say, the present tax year and do those transfers on the 6th of April, then those transfers have to be calculated at open market value. They have to be calculated with base costs, and capital gains tax would apply. So maybe a small window of opportunity, but if that is the situation, certainly look to sort out the divorce before the end of the tax year.
I suppose it might just be worth reinforcing as well that we do have different rates of capital gains tax applying to the selling of different types of assets. So some people are not necessarily au fait with the different rates. You want to just reconfirm that one for them?
Okay. Residential property is taxed for capital gains tax higher than every other asset, basically. I mean, the revenue have been cracking down on landlords for a couple of years now, and they use various methods to do this. They restrict the tax relief on interest, for example, and mortgage interest. Another way they crack down on landlords is to increase the rate of capital gains tax on the sale of residential property. Now, most people, they sell their home, it's been their home throughout the ownership, they're not caught by this. These are people who are selling homes which isn't covered by the main residence. So any other asset may have been taxed at 20%. If it's a residential property, it's then taxed at 28%. So even more reason to look at the ownership and see where we want the capital gain to land.
Okay. Again, I sound like a broken record, but the option of making a pension contribution to reduce the capital gains tax. So effectively, if you're making a gross contribution, that can have an impact on the capital gain. Do you want to quickly explain how that would work?
The pension contribution would reduce down the base, the rate of the capital gains tax liability. So the gain would be calculated the same. There's two rates of capital gains tax, and if we ignore the residential property, which is higher, those two rates are 10% and 20%. And so if we had a capital gain and we were being taxed at 20%, we might think about a pension contribution, which would bring the tax rate down, and more of that gain would land into the 10% basic rate band, effectively.
Okay.
Last thing I wanted to do on this was just to say, just maybe have a look at your share portfolio and see whether there are any assets in there standing at a large loss that you might want to use in this tax year to offset any large capital gains. Okay. You might have sold a property early on when we're now looking at capital gains tax. Have a look at the portfolio before the end of the tax year, because there may be some shares which are sitting there at a loss, and we can use that loss in the same year we've made the capital gain. Now, the thing with capital losses is we can't carry them back. So if you make a capital loss on the 6th of April, we can't use them against the current tax year. The gain has to be in the same year.
Okay, brilliant. Moving on, inheritance tax. And I think most of the focus on this is about ensuring the obvious exemptions are used. Maybe best if we watch to start with the normal gifting rules and the small gift rule, and then we can just touch on the gifting out of excess income.
Yes, because the inheritance tax is a little odd, isn't it? Because it usually works. Everybody knows about the 7-year rule, and that isn't seven tax years, that's seven calendar years from the date of gifting. So it's slightly different from income tax and capital gains tax. But the main exemption there is a £3,000 exemption. You are allowed each tax year. So you can give away, make a gift of up to £3,000 in a tax year, and that will not be caught by inheritance tax. If you die within 7 years, it will not be added back into your estate.
Okay. So if I just mentioned there about the small gift exemption. So that is in addition to the individual's annual exemption.
Yeah, that's £250. You can give £250, up to £250. Do not go 251. The first 250 will not be exempt. If you go to £251, the whole £251 is taxable. So instead, just up to £250, and you can do that to as many people as you want in the tax year. You can't do it to the same person, so you can't give £250 this month, £250 next month. No, that's £500. But you can give up to £250 to as many people as you want in the tax year. And again, that is a gift that is totally exempt from the date you've made the gift. And so should you die within 7 years, it's not then added back as a potentially exempt transfer.
and probably our pet favourite, the normal expenditure exemption, which we find is the most underutilised exemption ever seen. Fair to agree?
Oh, that's absolutely right, yes. So the way this exemption works is because your income is taxed, if you have surplus income and you want to give that surplus income away, that is then exempt for inheritance tax because the concept is it has already been taxed on you as income. You just need to be a little bit careful. A couple of things to look out for. This has to be out of surplus income, looking at one tax year to another. So we would need to make calculations to demonstrate to the revenue, should they ask, your income in this particular year was this much, this is your usual expenditure, whatever left is the surplus, and we can give that away, and that becomes exempt from the date of the gift. It's not a potentially exempt transfer, it won't be added back. But there's a couple of things that people look at. Maybe they might look to reduce their expenditure in a particular year to make the surplus bigger. Unfortunately, that doesn't work. Revenue will look from one year to the next to make sure you carried on with your usual expenditure. So if you go on an annual cruise, you also have to go on an annual cruise this way as well. You can't forego the annual cruise to give yourself more surplus income. The only other point I wanted to make there is that the gifts do have to be regular. Now, it does say regular, but it doesn't necessarily have to be every week, every month. Often what we have is grandparents will make, they will pay the children's school fees. So because they're making a payment every term, well, that's regular. It doesn't need to be more than once a year, but if we're doing it once a year, then we'd need to see it more than 1 year to show that it is regular.
Just picking up the specifics of that. So if we were saying people do irregular large holidays or once every 5, 6, 7 years change their car, what's the revenue's interpretation of gifting out of excess income? If you say every 6 or 7 years I change my car using a capital lump sum, or every 3, 4 years I'm going on these super duper cruises, and they appear to be more exceptional rather than annual, what's the revenue's interpretation then going to be of excess income in those years?
Well, if you're not taking those holidays and instead you take them the year after, for example, the revenue might think that you've manipulated your expenditure. You've delayed your holiday until next year to give you a surplus income this year to make the allowance. There is no hard and fast rule on this, but the trouble is going to be that when we claim this exemption, it'll be on your estate. You won't be here. And so it's trying to make sure there are as little arguments that revenue could put up to tackle this problem.
So was it a fair, what's downloadable online is the IHT 403?
Yes, one of the few revenue templates, which is actually very useful. This shows a number of columns, one column for each year, and then the rows running across, looks a bit like a spreadsheet, is spaces for you to enter your income. Below that, spaces to put all the regular expenditure. It might be rent, it might be mortgage payments, it could be life insurance, such like, and it takes the top half away from the bottom half. No, bottom half away from the top half to give a surplus income. And if we keep this running from 1 year to the next, it starts to build up contemporaneous history, which is very valuable when discussing inheritance tax with HMRC and trying to explain things after you're not here. And then we can show a trend that you're picking up and you're buying a car every 4 years or such like. So if we suddenly got a gift being made in year three, we can demonstrate, well, actually, you weren't going to buy a car in that year. That really is surplus income. So that is, as I said, one of the very few revenue forms which are really, really useful.
And you, as the wise owl, often advise people that the onus is on executors to, if you like, show gifts or evidence gifts, not for the inland revenue to be able to say, right, okay, we think that's a gift or whatever. It's going to be on the executives ultimately to probably show to the revenue that things weren't gifts, as it were. So people often get that the wrong way around.
Absolutely. Inheritance tax really is a political football, and revenue are looking more and more at inheritance tax, especially on estates. And so if I prepare an inheritance tax account and I'm claiming gifts which are exempt or various exemptions, revenue are going to look at these and every inheritance tax account actually passes through somebody's desk. It's not like a self-assessment tax return, which hits a computer and the computer runs an algorithm on it. This will run past somebody's desk, and they are looking to increase their inheritance tax take, as they are with every tax. And so if we are claiming for a gift, we are going to have to provide evidence to revenue that this really was a gift. And so any evidence that you can build up as you go along is very valuable. Always keep the letters. If you receive a gift, please keep the letters. Your executives are going to need it.
Good. Excellent. I just want to end by looking at one or two of the obvious tax-efficient investments that are available. And I think we've touched on ISAs, and the obvious benefit of the ISA is obviously it's going to keep the income tax off your return. The gains are going to be capital gains tax-free. Unfortunately, and many people don't perhaps overlook this, it's going to be in the net for inheritance tax purposes, but it's got a couple of very good tax breaks in terms of income tax and capital gains tax. So assuming that investors are not paying any extra for anybody to put money into an ISA, that is an obvious thing that you must be doing, and the contribution limits are now £20,000 a year. So, and I know you do advise people that you've got to be a bit mindful about that contribution limit is greater than your capital gains tax allowance. So you don't necessarily want to pay capital gains tax to put it in the ISA, but it just need, if you're not putting cash into the ISA, if you're going to do some of the bed and ISA-ing, the bed and whatever we discussed earlier, you just need to be slightly mindful of that. We covered off the, if you've got investments which are perhaps paying lower dividends, maybe those be the ones that you don't necessarily put into the ISA straight away. One thing we didn't mention before, there appear to be less of them around these days, but single premium life assurance bonds used to be very popular. I'm sure in no way, shape or form was that connected to the commission that was paid on the selling of those things. Might have been, but I don't want to go there. But if you are cashing in one of those investment bonds, again, where we talked before, a payment of a pension contribution can reduce the gain. Much to be said on that one, Robin, other than the fact that it's just going to reduce the chargeable event.
It's going to reduce the chargeable event, absolutely.
Yeah, so again, it's worth looking at if you're making a gain to pay into that, just potentially to reduce that chargeable event. The other two obvious things, enterprise investment schemes and venture capital trusts. These two things, slightly more esoteric than anything else we've touched on, and certainly for enterprise investment schemes, the government have had a good hard look at these recently, and fundamentally what you have to invest in has got to be sizably more risky than it used to be. Venture capital trusts, you've probably got a little bit of a wider remit, but you really do need a good eye on actually what you're investing in, because we can all get a little bit blindsided by the 30% income tax relief on the way in and the fact that they pay tax-free dividends. But ultimately, again, you want to be having a decent eye on what's happening to the capital underlying capital value. So those are the obvious tax-efficient investments.
And the risk is there in those investments, absolutely fine. But given as we're now... Well, we're 10 months into this current tax year. We have 2 months to go before the end of the tax year. This is one of the few tools still available whereby if we find ourselves with an income tax problem, we've got we have some time now to make these investments and claim that 30% tax relief. And if we need to do it this tax year rather than wait till the next, time is of the essence.
Brilliant. So I'm hoping the half an hour we've just spent has given you some decent nuggets. The intention will be to tap into Robin's expertise and maybe have a deeper dive into some of these subjects over the next few months. So perhaps we'll do specific podcasts on inheritance tax, on capital gains tax or income tax, where we'll just go deeper and deeper. But for the time being, it's goodbye from myself and
goodbye from me.